Tonight we're going to begin the book of Deuteronomy. Having finished the book of Nehemiah last time, I was in a little bit of a quandary as to just which book we'd want to start in next time. And I chose Deuteronomy because it seems to be a kind of a pivotal book. As you know, the book of Genesis is the beginning. And it does begin with the creation of the world and the story of Adam and Eve and their descendants, of the flood that destroyed the earth by water with Noah and the building of the ark, the descendants of Noah, Abraham, his journeys, his call and promise, and the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then the book of Genesis ends with the people in captivity in Egypt. Then we have the book of Exodus, which is the going out of captivity, going out of Egypt. And it gives that story of the call of Moses and the plagues that were brought upon Egypt and the things that were necessary for God to get his people out of that state of captivity. And then the book of Leviticus has to do with the Levites and the ordinances given to the Levitical priesthood. And then next is the book of Numbers, which deals primarily with the wanderings of the 40 years in the wilderness. And then Deuteronomy, which is the fifth book, known as the second giving of the law. Deuteronomy is kind of a pivotal book because it is given just before the people enter into the promised land. They finish their 40 years wandering now in the wilderness. Most of the people that are just ready to go into the promised land did not experience those earlier things. They didn't experience the Exodus. They didn't experience the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, nor Mount Sinai, the giving of the law, and those things that are so basic to the heritage of the Jewish people. And so this book of Deuteronomy is the account of Moses giving them the last minute reminder and instruction about what the whole plan of God really is about for them just before they go into the promised land. He's talking to people that many of them were born after the Ten Commandments were given. Their parents or their grandparents had died in the wilderness. And so the contact made with the captivity in Egypt and the earlier promises of God had been broken due to the disobedience of the people and the necessary death that God brought upon them in the wilderness of all that was over the age of 20. So now Moses has his last chance to remind them of those necessary things. And Moses, as you know, will not be allowed to go into the land of promise himself because of his disobedience. I'd like to read a little passage here that Mr. Adam Clark said about this. Moses here repeats the principal occurrences of the 40 years now almost elapsed, shows them the absolute necessity of fearing, loving, and obeying God, repeats the Ten Commandments, and particularly explains each and the ordinances belonging to them, adding others which he had not delivered before, confirms the whole law in a most solemn manner, with exceeding great and precious promises to them that keep it, and a denunciation of the most awful judgments against those who should break it, renews the covenant between God and the people, prophesies of things which should come to pass in the latter days, blesses each of the tribes prophetically with the choicest spiritual and temporal blessings, and then, having viewed the whole extent of the land from the top of Mount Nebo or Pisgah, he yielded up the ghost and was privately buried by God, leaving Joshua the son of Nun for his successor. So that's just a brief statement that Mr. Clark makes about the scope and purpose of this book of Deuteronomy. This name, the Deuteronomy, which means the second law, or the second giving of the law, it's from another word, iteration, which means the doubling. It's a repeat of many of the things that have already happened. It's a giving again of the Ten Commandments. But you can see the necessity for this. We're really talking to a new nation now. Not the same nation that came out of Egypt, but a new generation of people. And so this seemed to be a necessary thing before they went into the land to have them re-established, reaffirmed, and all of these basic principles that God had for them. Many of the things in Deuteronomy are are quoted again in the New Testament. When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, the 40 days, the three statements that he made back to Satan, in which he quoted from the scriptures, he quotes from the book of Deuteronomy. There are prophecies in here about Christ. And so this is an important book, as all of the books in the Bible are. So as we begin in the first chapter, in the first verse of the book of Deuteronomy, "These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel on this side Jordan in the wilderness." So here we have all of these 600,000 people now encamped on the east side of the Jordan in the plain there known as the Plain of Moab, waiting the crossing. Now, it's hard for us to realize just how many people 600,000 people are. But it's an enormous number of people. And all of the wives and families and all the everything that goes along with it it makes a tremendous encampment of people. Some of our larger cities, such as the city of Fort Worth, are not as large as 600,000. And so you can see how it takes us in an automobile maybe an hour to drive across from one side to the other of that city. And you can see then what a large group of people this is. And so they're waiting now, waiting to cross over into over the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. And these are the words which Moses spake. Now there's some things in this first verse that are a little bit difficult to explain because of the names that he gives here. He says, "In the wilderness, in the plain over against the Red Sea, between Paran and Tophel and Laban and Hazeroth and Dizahab." Now it seems from what he's saying here, these names that he's giving the boundaries of this encampment of the people. And he names names that we don't know really their root. And so when he says those such names as the plain over against the Red Sea, that makes us think of back down in the Sinai Peninsula, close to where they came out of the land of Egypt, where they'd been for 40 years. But the Bible scholars seem to say that that's not what he means here. This word plain really means the plain of Moab, and over against the Red Sea, the word red should not, word sea really should not be there. It's talking about another place besides the Red Sea. And between Paran was a wilderness down in the Sinai Peninsula, but apparently it's another place here. And so it's a little hard to differentiate this, but all of these places are probably just boundaries of where the people were encamped at this present time. Then in verse 2 he says, "There are 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir unto Kadesh Barnea." Now that seems a little strange to me that he'd throw that phrase in here, but let's talk about it for just a minute. 11 days' journey from Horeb. Now Horeb is Mount Horeb, or Mount Sinai, where they received the law, where they received the Ten Commandments. And as you go from Horeb, which is down to the very south of the Sinai Peninsula, as you go from there up north by the way of Mount Seir unto Kadesh Barnea, this Kadesh Barnea was the very center of some of their operations. And we're going to learn a lot more about it. Much of Numbers is involved with their dealings with this area of Kadesh Barnea. As you go from there up to Kadesh Barnea, he said it's 11 days' journey. And so he just has it in parentheses and just stops. And I don't know exactly what the application is supposed to be, but we can make some applications of it. The outstanding thing is that they did go from Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea, and that's where God sent them to go into the land of Canaan originally, and that's when they refused to go. And so because of their refusal, he made them stay in the wilderness for the next 38 years, and they wandered around for 38 years in this space that he describes here as an 11 days journey. So you can see how that they were rather confined by having to stay in that area that they could travel in 11 days travel. And there's not very much said about that 38 years in the wilderness. It's kind of a lost period with the people because there's just not much in the Bible that tells what happened. Now, continuing with our narrative, verse 3, "And it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spake unto the children of Israel, according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment unto them." Now, here we are in the 40th year. As we mentioned, they had wandered for 38 years. They stayed at Sinai for almost a year, 11 months, before they ever left Sinai. And then they refused to go into the land, and they wandered for some 38 years. And now in the 40th year, they started on their final journey up to Canaan. Now, this 40th year was kind of a landmark year in a lot of ways. In the first month of the 40th year, Miriam died, who was the sister of Aaron and Moses. In the fifth month of that year, Aaron died. We discussed that a time or two back when they went up on the mountain, you know, and Aaron took off the robe of his priesthood and gave it to Eleazar, and he died. And then in the 12th month of this year, Moses died. Well, here we are in the 11th month, the first day of the 11th month of this 40th year. And Moses is speaking on that day. Now, the book of Deuteronomy only covers about a five-week period. It covers all of this 11th month, and it goes through the first 7 days of the 12th month, 7 days after Moses dies. It gets him right up to the crossing over into Jordan. So the number of years or time that Deuteronomy covers in its actual self is only about 5 weeks, but yet it tells about the history as they go up to this time. So it came to pass in the 40th year in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spake unto the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment unto them. Now this seemed to be some of these same special commandments unto them at this time through Moses. After he had slain Sihon the king of the Amorites, which dwelt in Heshbon, and Og the king of Bashan, which dwelt in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Now, you know, we talked about the slaying of these two kings back when we had the 10th chapter of Nehemiah. And we're not going to go through this again, but I would refer you to that lesson to cover this event of those two kings and those two countries that were conquered at that time. Verse 5, on this side Jordan, in the land of Moab, began Moses to declare this law, saying. Now, he says in the land of Moab. This plain of Moab really wasn't the land of Moab at the time they conquered it. It belonged to Heshbon and to Og, the king of Bashan, but it had priorly belonged to Moab, so that it had been their possession long enough time that it was still called the plain of Moab. Verse 6, the Lord our God spake unto us in Horeb, saying, you have dwelt long enough in this mount. Now remember, Horeb, it's Mount Sinai. When they crossed over the Red Sea and went into the wilderness, they were there for some 3 months. And then they came to Mount Sinai, and this is when they received the Ten Commandments. Now remember, we also talked about this occasion one time in the book of Nehemiah. But as a matter of fact, we talked about some of those events in Numbers enough. That's the reason I didn't choose Numbers to start in tonight. The great Mount Sinai was surrounded by the people. They were not to come within so close a distance of the mountain. Moses went up with Aaron, went to receive the Ten Commandments. While he was gone, they built the golden calf. They really started idolatrous worship. They were dancing and playing and making all kinds of noise. Those who've been to that area describe it very graphically as being just exactly the way that it would and could have happened as given in the book of Exodus. Well, they were there after they received this law for some 11 months. Now, God was so unhappy with the people. Many of them were destroyed. He built his tabernacle and he made them take it out of the camp. He wouldn't even have his tabernacle in the camp of the people. His tabernacle was without the camp, and so when Moses wanted to meet with God, he and the elders, they went out there to meet with God. God wouldn't come into the camp with the people. He was so displeased with them. And this is where they began then with the laws, the Levitical priesthood. They were there for 11 months, from the third month of the first year to the second month of the second year. And then God told them, they'd been there long enough. You dwelt long enough in this mount. Turn you and take your journey and go to the Mount of the Amorites. So they were now to leave this place and go northward and inhabit the land of Canaan. It was only a year now, and they were ready to go and take the land of Canaan. God was ready for them to do this. They'd been here long enough. And so in verse 7, he describes the boundaries of the land. And these boundaries are interesting as we look at them. He says, go to the Mount of the Amorites, and into all the places nigh thereunto, in the plain, in the hills, and in the vale, and in the south, and by the seaside, to the land of the Canaanites, and unto Lebanon, and unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, this is a very large area that he describes here, larger than just what we think of as Palestine. And he starts by talking about the Mount of the Amorites. This Mount of the Amorites was actually down south of Palestine, south of the Nebo, south of Beersheba. It was a mountainous range that extended east and west for some 70 miles, and it was about 40 miles wide, and this was to be the southern boundary, and it was to belong to his people, the Mount of the Amorites. And so that's where they were to go to, and that's where Kadesh Barnea really was located, right in that vicinity. That was their point of operation. That was where they were to use as a springboard as they encompassed the land. But he further tells about these boundaries. And he says, and unto all the places nigh thereunto, all the places near thereunto. And he describes it in such a way that it would include every part of it. He says, in the plain, in the hills, and in the vale. So whether it's a mountain, whether it's a valley, whether it's a plain, it doesn't matter, it's yours. The plains, the hills, and the vales. And in the south. Now, in the south is probably a region rather than just a direction. And there was an area there that's called the Nego. And the Negeb. And that was known as the south country. The Negeb was the south country. And so that was to be theirs too. And by the seaside to the land of the Canaanites. Now, the seaside, of course, was as far as they could go west. That was the Mediterranean Ocean. That was the boundary on the west side, the Mediterranean Ocean. And under Lebanon, that was the boundary to the north. You know, we know about Lebanon even today, and we read about them getting the cedars of Lebanon. Lebanon is mentioned many times in the Old Testament. And then unto the great river, the river Euphrates, that was the boundary on the east. So the Euphrates River on the east, which is way over beyond Jordan, the Mediterranean Sea on the west, the Lebanon to the north, and then to the south there they had the Mount of the Amorites. So a huge area. And we do read over in 1 Kings, the 4th chapter, verse 21, where it seems at one time during Solomon's reign, they did have all of this very land that is outlined here. But it's far more than just Palestine proper. Verse 8, behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give unto them and to their seed after them. I've set it before you. It's ready. It's the same way as if he were saying it's a plum that's ripe for the picking. The land is ready, you go get it. All you have to do is go take it. He swear it to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their seed after them. Verse 9. Now, in verse 9, he kind of changes the subject here a little bit, but we're going to get back to this original subject in a little while. And I spake unto you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear you myself alone. Now, up until this time, it seems that Moses had been carrying all of the cares of this huge number of people. And this is for about a year or so now. He'd been settling all their disputes. He'd been hearing all the complaints. He'd been making all the judgments about everything. And so he says, I'm not able to bear you myself alone. The Lord your God hath multiplied you, and behold, ye are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude. As you remember, back in Genesis 15 and 5, God made that promise to Abraham. He says, go out and look at the stars, and we'll make your children, your seed, as the stars of the heavens. Now, there are those who want to mock and ridicule the Bible and say, well, this is a great farce, that he didn't have near as many people as there are stars in the heaven. There are millions of stars, billions, uncountable stars. But if you stop and think for a minute, he told Abraham to go out and look. Now, with what you could see with the naked eye, the scientists say that you can see some 3,000 or so stars with the naked eye. Well, here he had 600,000 descendants. So when you put it in that light of what he told Abraham to do and what the promise really said, then he more than adequately fulfilled that promise. And that's what Moses is saying right here, that they are as the stars of heaven for multitude. And during that day and time, they didn't have the telescopes to look at the heavens that we have today. They just looked with their naked eye. And maybe they had made a count of the stars. I don't know. In verse 11, he says, the Lord God of your fathers make you 1,000 times so many more as you are, and bless you as he hath promised you. And it was Moses' will to be even more. He wasn't complaining because they had that many people. It'd be fine if it'd be 1,000 times more people than they had. But he arrived at the point where he could no longer bear all the problems. So in verse 12, how can I myself alone bear your cumbrance and your burden and your strife? Now, you know, any time there's a group of people together, even if everything is going just as well as it possibly can, there is going to be these cumbrances, these problems, what he calls here your burden and your strife. There's going to be frictions. There's going to be misunderstandings. There's going to be problems that have to be ironed out. And they had it then, and they were making a provision to take care of it. And the same is true in the church. It's true in every family. We have to be able to deal with our problems and to deal with each other. We have to be able to communicate. We have to be able to be submissive one to another. And whatever plan is outlined, there must be some kind of a provision for submissiveness. If not, there's no way that we're going to ever be able to get along. We have to be able to listen to one another and understand one another and have a feeling for one another. So this is the way they set about to take care of this. Verse 13. Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. Now, they weren't just to get anybody. Wise men, he says, and understanding. Men who are able to feel and to understand and to grasp the reality and the justice of a situation. And known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And ye answered me and said, the thing which thou hast spoken is good for us to do. Now Moses is recounting the history back from the time they left Mount Sinai, back 40 years ago. And it's well for these people to be well grounded in this, because they followed this same system of judges on after they got into Canaan. This stayed with the people for a long time, this same system. It was a good system. And so Moses needed to remind them, this is the way that we decided to do it, and this is the way that it is. And so the thing which I have spoken is good for us to do. So, verse 15, I took the chief of your tribes, wise men, and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, and captains over hundreds, and captains over fifties, and captains over tens, and officers among your tribes. So the way this was set up then, they had captains that were some over thousands, some over hundreds, some over tens. And as we look at the total picture then, we see at the top of the hierarchy, we see Moses and Aaron and the priests, and then these men that were selected to be captains over thousands and in hundreds and then tens, and then he names those that are officers among your tribe, those that would carry out lesser duties among the tribes. So that if there was a dispute, there was one person that just had 10 people to look after. He was over tens. And then if it was something that he couldn't handle, there was another that had 100 to look over. And then he could go on higher than that to one who was over 1,000. You see the way this thing was set up, it's a miraculous, wonderful system. A system of judges. A system where these hundreds of thousands of people could get along with each other. And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him. Now, what this judge is supposed to do was to hear the causes between the brethren. Now, that's where we fall down a lot of time is we're not willing to hear, not willing to listen to the other person's point of view. Maybe that other person's not willing to tell us his point of view. Or we're not willing to listen. We fail to communicate. The first step in any kind of a solving of a problem is to be able to communicate about the problem. It's true in our study of the Bible. If we have a point of doctrine that we'd like to discuss with somebody, or like to get them to see or to understand, unless we can discuss it with them, we're powerless and they're hopeless as far as ever being able to see it. Even if it's another brother in the church, we have to be able to discuss. And if we have such an emotional feeling about something that we can't even talk about it without getting into a row, or get our feelings all hurt about it, then we'll never work it out, whether it be a point of doctrine or whether it be just some matter of friction or misunderstanding. We have to be able to talk and understand. We just can't draw off into a shell and not have anything to do with anybody or say about it and have our own feelings and expect to come out. It's not going to work that way. He told these judges, he says, hear the causes between your brethren and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that's with him. It doesn't matter even if there's a stranger there. He also is entitled to be heard and have righteous judgment given. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment. Now, that's a very definite principle of God that holds even down to the present day. We're not to be respecters of persons. God's not a respecter of persons. We're not to be, and these people were not. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of a man. Now, to be afraid of the face of a man would be, here's one person that carries more authority than somebody else, and so he intimidates you as you would pass judgment. You're going to lean in his favor, and you're going to slide somebody else because you're afraid of the face of this man. For the judgment is God's. Now, that's an important phrase there. It's not just some kind of a judgment that doesn't make any difference. He says the judgment is God's. And the cause that is too hard for you, bring it unto me, and I will hear it. So what they couldn't hear, what they couldn't work out among themselves, then Moses would take those tough cases, and he would hear it himself. So you see what a tremendous burden this took off of Moses and how that it allowed the people assisting then to judge themselves. And I believe that this system was first introduced by Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, which brings us up to an interesting point. Jethro was a man who was a priest of the Midianites. He was a heathen. He was a Gentile. He was not an Israelite. But he, no doubt, had become a proselyte to the Israelite nation. And so he represents a type then of the Gentile people coming into the people of God. He's like a wild olive branch being grafted into the natural tree. And so he is figurative and symbolic in many ways of the Gentile today. And he had something to offer. He offered this system of judges. He suggested it to Moses. And you can see then how that it was carried out, and it was one of the most important aspects of their life together from this point on. Verse 18, and I commanded you at that time all the things which ye should do. Now that covers a whole wide area there, all the things you should do. Verse 19, and when we departed from Horeb, now Horeb, remember, is the mount where Mount Sinai was. God said, you've been here long enough. Now is the time for you to go on up there to this mount of the Amorites and take the land that's yours. And he outlined the boundary for them. When we departed from Horeb, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness, which you saw by the way of the mountain of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. Here again we talk about Kadesh Barnea. This is the kind of the center of operation. It's the place that God sent them to. And it was to be their point of operation as they launched into a conquering of the land of Canaan, which they failed to do. They did not do what God wanted. And we're going to see then that as they wandered in this wilderness for the next 38 years, when they finally decided then, and God decided that the time had been long enough, what did he have them to do? They came back to Kadesh Barnea. That was the place to start again, the second time when they made their last trip then on up to the edge of Canaan, which is where they are now. And when you have a chance, get your map out of the Sinai Peninsula and look up Kadesh Barnea. Look up Mount Horeb. And see where these places are so you can get some idea as to what we're talking about. They're down to the south of Canaan in what was known as the wilderness. Now, another thing that's interesting here to me, in Numbers, the 10th chapter, we have an account of a man known as Hobab. Hobab was a brother-in-law to Moses. He was also from the Midianites. He was a son of the father-in-law of Moses. And so in Numbers 10, I'd like to read just a few verses there, beginning with the 29th verse. And Moses said unto Hobab, the son of Raguel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, and incidentally it's thought that this Raguel was another name for Jethro, we are journeying under the place of which the Lord said, I will give it you. Come thou with us, and we will do thee good, for the Lord has spoken good concerning Israel. Now they were leaving the mount, as we were reading in Deuteronomy, but before they left, Moses invited Hobab to come with them. Hobab was a Midianite. He wasn't an Israelite. He was another one of these Gentiles. But I want you to notice the exchange here is what Moses said. And he said unto him, I will not go, but I will depart to mine own land and to my kindred. Hobab declined the invitation. And he said, "Leave us not, I pray thee, for as much as thou knowest how we are to encamp in the wilderness, and thou mayest be to us instead of eyes." Here, you can help us. You can be to us instead of eyes. Now remember, they had the cloud to guide them by day. They had the fire to guide them by night. God was guiding them, but yet Moses invited this man who knew the country, he was a native of this area, to come along and to be their eyes, to help them to know where to encamp. And so this tells us then that even though God has a plan for us and we have his Bible that we go to, that we still have to use our own intelligence about some of the minor details. Some of the details may have to be worked out by those who are wise and who know. "And it shall be, if thou go with us, yea, it shall be, that what goodness the Lord shall do unto us, the same will we do unto thee." So he persuaded him to go, and he said, whatever good thing happens to us, the same thing's going to happen to you, because you're going to be with us, and you'll be a part of us. So that's another interesting little aside as we talk about this. Back to Deuteronomy 1, verse 20. "And I said unto you, ye are come unto the mountain of the Amorites, which the Lord our God doth give unto us." And we know we discussed that a while ago. It's this mountain to the southernmost area of the territory they were to occupy, the range of mountains. Now this area of the mountain of the Amorites is an interesting area if we just had time to explore it and talk about it. It was an area in which Abraham and Isaac came years and years before. When Abraham first made the journey across from Ur of the Chaldees, and as he came down through Palestine, he went over into Egypt, and then he came back through this area. He dug some wells here. It was an area where the fertility of the country began to be a lot better now. This wasn't like the wilderness down there. This was a much more fertile area. There was a lot of grape vine areas in here that produced heavily of the fruit. And so the people, as they could see this territory, they could see the roots of old, they could see where their forefathers had been, and even today there's some areas there that are pretty well identified as where Abraham had been, and maybe even some wells that were dug by them. And they could see that the land was now a lot better, a lot more palatable, a lot more productive. And so this was the beginning of what had been promised to them as they were here on this Mount of the Amorites. "Behold, the Lord thy God has set the land before thee. Go up and possess it, as the Lord thy God of thy father has said unto thee. Fear not, neither be discouraged." Now everything was all set. They had the law, the commandments, they had the priesthood, they had the tabernacle, they had Moses, they had God, they had everything all set. They were out on the very edge of taking this land. And he said, go up and possess it. Fear not, neither be discouraged. And then we have problems, beginning with verse 22. "And ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men before us, and they shall search out the land, and bring us word again by what way we must go up, and into what cities we shall come." And then he says, "And the saying pleased me well, and I took 12 men of you, one of a tribe." Now, this probably wasn't in the original plan. And we learn here, this is the only place where it's stated like this, that the idea really came from the people. The people suggested that they send the spies out and to investigate the land. And then as we read about this same account over here in Numbers 13, it sounds as though God gave the command, but it probably happened like this. The people got the idea, they brought it to Moses, Moses took it to God, and God okayed it. Because Numbers 13 begins by saying, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them." So this names the men who were sent. Each one was a ruler of a tribe. They weren't just anybody. These were highly influential people that they sent. And Moses further instructs these men in Numbers 13, verse 17, "And Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwell therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many, and what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. And he goes on and tells them, you spy out the land. Now it says get southward, which means to go, actually to go north into this Negev area, which is the south area. But they were south of the south area, so they had to go north to go south. It doesn't make good sense because the translation here is not really the proper translation. So they were to really check this land out. See what the land is, whether it be lean or fat, whether there be wood therein or not. And be ye of good courage and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the end of the first ripe grapes. And that time was the end of July, the end of the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob as men come to Hamath. Now this Rehob is up in the far north area of the land. The wilderness of Zin is in the south, so they encompassed the whole land. And they did from what we can determine here, a fairly thorough search of the land. And this entire 13th chapter of Numbers and the 14th chapter of Numbers has to do with this event. And it's hard to start reading it and to find a place to stop. There's not any good place to stop when you start reading it because it just tells the story in a continuity that really is rather complete. So we go back to Deuteronomy, verse 22. And ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men. Well, I've already read that verse. Verse 24. And they turned and went up into the mountain and came unto the valley of Eshcol and searched it out. Now, as we get the story here, where they were camped at Kadesh Barnea, there was a plain over to the northern eastern area, and that's where the Canaanites and Amorites were, and they did have a conflict with them. But these spies, in order to be able to go, had to go to the west, which was by the mountain. They went up by the mountain, and that's how they were able to get by, being seen by the Amorites and Canaanites who were camped in the plain. And they came to the valley of Eshcol. This word Eshcol means the grapes. And this valley of Eshcol was so productive and fertile, it seems, that as they came back, they took a bunch of grapes, and they hung them on a rod, and two men carried them in. That seemed like an awful big bunch of grapes, but that's the way the Bible describes it in Numbers 13. And they brought the pomegranates and other things to show the proof of the fruitfulness of the land. Verse 25, and they took of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down unto us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land which the Lord our God doth give us. Notwithstanding, ye would not go up, but rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. They refused to go because the 10 of these spies said they couldn't take the land. Let's go back to Numbers 13 and read some of that. Beginning with verse 23. And they came unto the brook of Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between two upon a staff. And they brought of the pomegranates and the figs. The place was called the brook Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes where the children of Israel cut down from thence. And they returned from searching of the land after 40 days. And they went and came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel under the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh. That's where they were camped, Kadesh Barnea. And brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them and said, we came unto the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey. This is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great, and moreover we saw the children of Anak there. Now this Anak was a race of people, probably, who were considered to be giants because of their great stature, and so they just took great fear whenever they realized this race of people, the children of Anak, dwelt there. The Amalekites dwelt in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwelt in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwelt by the sea and by the coast of Jordan. Now, of course, they name each tribe and where they dwelt. Well, what did they expect to find? A land completely uninhabited? They knew there were people there, but they painted up as though it's a dread place. The Canaanites are over by the sea, and the Amalekites dwell in the south, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. There's just no way we can take this land. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men that went up with him said, "We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." And they brought up an evil report of the land, which they had searched under the children of Israel, saying, "The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature." And there we saw the giants, the son of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. So these 12 or 10 spies really paint up a dark picture of this. And this, in a lot of ways, is a type and antitype of our life today as a Christian. Now, anybody who sets out to live the Christian life needs to know that it's a life that God has promised that He's going to be with us and He's going to allow us to be successful. But it's also a life that's going to be hard. It's difficult. There's going to be giants in there. And there, it's a land that it eateth up the inhabitants, so to speak, because you've seen people start out the Christian life and who fall. They fail to make it. It eats up the inhabitants. You're better off, maybe some might say, not even try that, because it's so difficult to live the Christian life, to live up to all the things that God has required of you to do, that it's just so impossible that it's no use to even try. Man just can't do it. That's what they were saying here about Canaan. We just can't do it. There's people over there, and they're going to fight us, and they're bigger than we are. But they were leaving out the fact that God had promised them the land and that God was going to be with them. Sure, nobody can live up to the Christian life without God helping, without the grace and the mercy and the power of God. But with His power, we can do it. We can overcome and we can take the land of Canaan, which is ours, for the taking. He's promised it to us in this figurative sense. Well, as the story goes on, the congregation lifted up their voice. They cried all night. There was a terrible din, terrible uproar. Caleb and Joshua, they rent their clothing and they cried and they tried to plead for the right cause for them to go and take the land. The people threatened to stone them. And they wanted to get another leader. So let's go back into Egypt. Why, all of our wives and our little ones here, he brought them out into this wilderness so that they're going to be destroyed. Let's go back over to Egypt. And they just really created a tremendous uprising there against Moses, against Caleb and Joshua, and against God. Well, let's go on with our story in Deuteronomy. Verse 27. "And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us and hath brought us forth out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the land of the Amorites to destroy us. Whither shall we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people is greater and taller than we. The cities are great and walled up to heaven. And moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakims there." Now, you remember, these spies that were saying, "We can't take the land," they were leaders of the tribes. They were the most prominent men. It wasn't just somebody that had no influence. They were highly influential people. And they were saying, "We can't do it." "Then I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God which goeth before you, He shall fight for you, according to all that He did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness, for thou hast seen how that the Lord thy God bare thee, as a man doth bear his son, in all the way that ye went until ye came into this place. Yet in this thing did ye not believe the Lord your God." Now that's what it boils down to. It's a matter of believing. Believing God. Believing what God has said. Believing what He's promised. And I mean believing to the point that...